You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Hearst Ranch. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, go to HearstRanch.com. Welcome to Why We Cook, the Chef Smarty Pants radio show. I'm Erica Wides, Chef Smarty Pants, your host. And tonight I have a guest in the studio, which is very exciting because I rarely allow guests on this program unless I feel like they're someone I really want to talk to. This is great because my guest tonight is someone who I've been trying to have on the show for a long time, and we finally worked it out. So, my guest tonight is Sim Cass. Hello, Sim.
Hello, Erica.
How are you?
I'm going to try and be on my best behavior.
Okay. You can sit a little closer to the mic, too, okay. So you don't have to lean. So, Sim and I are co-instructors. We're colleagues at the cooking school in Manhattan where I teach ICE. And he is a bread and pastry instructor, but primarily bread, right?
Bread is my world.
Bread is your world. Yeah, so Sim is like the bread guy in New York. He's like the premier bread god of New York. That's, you know, generally agreed to be that. And we have been talking for a long time at ICE about having him come on the show. And we finally worked it out because we're often both running around the world, leaving off on projects. And so we finally got it together and got you on the show, which is great. And when we were talking about what we should talk about, we both were sort of along the lines of maybe we should talk about the history of fermentation of dough. You know, that people first started actually grinding their grains into pastes or flours and then mixing them with water and forming them into little cakes and baking them. But at some point, they probably mixed it into a little paste and left it out by mistake and saw these funny bubbles develop in it and realized that it made it taste better and it made it rise.
Right.
Which would be like the beginning of naturally fermented grains.
Right. That would be the Egyptians that seem to have beat everybody to the post because their economy was based on flour or wheat.
Mm-hmm.
The Nile Basin basically flooded once a year. Then the water went receded and they planted wheat.
Mm-hmm.
So they had lots of wheat. And at some point, obviously, when they were just making these flat cakes, they were mixing flour and water together.
They're making matzah, basically.
Yeah, basically sort of flat. Put it on this hot rock next to the oven. And one could imagine that somewhere in that process, they didn't cook it all that day. And the next day, you know, they noticed that maybe yesterday's dough rose a little bit or had a few bubbles in it.
Right, got kind of foamy.
There you go. So they started doing this on, obviously started doing this on purpose, and they started to get risen bread. And we kind of know this because in the tombs of the Egyptian pharaohs, after they died, of course, they were prepared for the afterlife by having, you know, having murdered all their servants and wives, etc. They also, you know, probably, you know, a few bakers thrown in there for good measure, but they had the hieroglyphics on some of these tombs depicted how to start your own bakery, basically 101 for when you regain consciousness and can't remember how to do it.
Or like if you wanted to open a bakery in the afterlife.
There you go. Yeah, business plan for the future.
Yeah.
So on these hieroglyphics and all these like sort of diagrams were, you know, the method of making bread, and in there with all the equipment that you needed and how many people you needed, etc., was the diagram showing you how to, you know, sort of basically pre-ferment bread and get yourself a nice risen dough. So we sort of know that because we have a record that goes like 3,500 years before Christ. So there you go. That's how we know, mm-hmm. basically, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you were saying yesterday when we were talking about it that now there's new evidence that this was going on way before the Egyptians. Because I remember hearing about the Egyptians and that they had these sort of flower pot-shaped vessels that they baked their bread in, and they were archaeological digs where they discovered actual dried sourdough starter still in those pots that you could reconstitute with water and they still worked, which is incredible. But then you said yesterday that you knew about this happening even earlier.
Right. Well, now the latest ones, these Italians have done this study on this, basically these old grinding stones and stuff that they got from villages that they've dated 30,000 years ago. And they found starch and vegetable starches ground into these mortars. And also on these stones that they cooked by the fire with, they found sort of remnants, I guess, of old bread-type products, which is now making us 30,000 years ago, which is basically prehistoric guy. So they were thinking that it was just meat, vegetables, what you could catch, eat it type living.
Right.
And no, now there's proof that they were actually grinding, you know, making some sort of, I can't call it a dough, but it would be like a paste, where they would, you know, cook it on the side of the fire and eat it with their steaks.
Steaks, so to speak, right? Yeah. The prehistoric version of me would have cut up the animal into the steak, and you, the prehistoric version of you, would be there grinding the paste. A little gender role reversal, too.
Well, also, I think what would happen is that if we were sitting by the fire every night of our lives, okay, sort of hearing wolves howling, etc., and we had all that time on our hands whilst we would be cooking our steak or antelope or what have you, we would probably play around with what can we eat with it. And I like to think that even though maybe we couldn't speak that well, I'm sure people did do that. Some guys probably didn't. Some of them probably just, you know, threw the whole animal on the fire, you know, had a fight or two or whatever they do.
Yeah.
And then had a big feed up.
But well, like your typical Sunday afternoon barbecue.
Yeah, kind of like football day or something. You know?
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of people who that's how they cook. You know, they just throw a chunk of meat on the fire and burn the crap out of it.
Yeah.
Not everybody has the finesse.
It's the fire, though, isn't it? Just being outside with the fire.
It's the fire. It's the primal thing. Yeah. Right, right. Well, you know, when I first came on the air with this show, the sort of the first show I did and the original idea of the show was that, you know, the reason why we cook is because it's what humanized us. It's what sort of brought us down from the trees and changed us from hunter-gatherers to these, you know, tribal societies where once we harnessed fire, we realized that we could cook our food in it, and by cooking it, it would make it much more available to us. You could consume much more food in a day if you cooked it because it made it much easier to chew and digest, and that's how we evolved to have such big brains, and we socialized and all of that. And so, you know, there was thousands and thousands of years of experimentation and trial and error that went along with all of that.
Yes.
Yes. But people first started sort of planned agriculture and cultivating grains how long ago?
Well, no, I still think that's more, I think that's definitely Egyptian in terms of
the Fertile Crescent.
Well, they said that, they had all the, they had all that wheat, and essentially had to pay tithes or whatever to, you know, the certain amount of this wheat belonged to the religious side and certain amount belonged to the kings or whatever, and you were left with enough to keep you going. So it, what everybody had was wheat, so it was like a culture of bread, you know. And I want to say that the Jewish tribes maybe were nomadic. I'm just going to bring this in.
Okay.
Sort of political. But, okay. You know, like, so you've got your...
Feel free.
Yeah, no, it's okay. We said no religion or politics. But
no,
just
I didn't
a little
say
bit.
That.
Oh, we didn't?
No.
Okay.
No,
well,
that's...
We're talking about something else.
That's at work.
All right.
We were talking
No, that
about
was my health regime.
Getting...
We're going to talk about.
No, we were talking about how we... My most recent evaluations at work, it was said that I was too sarcastic and too liberal.
I know. Extraordinary.
It's ridiculous. It how is. Can you be too sarcastic or too liberal?
I don't know. It's worrying.
Yeah.
Where was I? Oh, yes. Okay.
I remember.
We were talking about the Jewish
faith. Oh, the Jewish tribes.
Came up with, the tribes came up with, okay, no, that's it. You can't, you know, if we look at it in a religious point of view, it was like because you can't eat risen bread, right? Remember that was
right.
one of the things?
Yeah, on Passover, right. Unleavened bread.
Right. So, but if you think about it, that's very clever because by saying you can't eat risen bread, you sort of take yourself out of the political or the tithe stuff to the kings. You know, you sort of like separate yourself and keep yourself a nomadic tribe, as it were. I just thought it was worth mentioning.
Okay. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break.
Okay.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune into The Food Scene Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network. Hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel, photo editor of Edible Brooklyn and Edible Manhattan magazines, he'll further explore the amalgamation of food and art by talking to artists from a multitude of media. Guests will range from photographers, food stylists, interior architects for restaurants, industrial designers, all the players that make you want to eat with your eyes. Get ready to feast your ears every Tuesday at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to Why We Cook, the Chef Smarty Pants radio show on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm Erica Wides, Chef Smarty Pants, your host. And with me tonight, I have a very special guest. When I was posting about what the show was about tonight, I said that it was about, you know, man's quest to trap and control wild yeast. And I said that my guest tonight was the wildest yeast of all, Simcas. Because, you know, you are somewhat revered.
Right,
well, for your...
Yes, I know. I'm being very calm.
You have been very calm.
Very calm.
I've never seen you like this, sitting all polite. And you're usually a little more kinetic.
Well, we'll see. See how it goes.
Frantic.
Well, we were going to talk about, now that we're on the subject of wild yeast. So essentially, that was always how we made bread. And that would be the old secret that bakers had over the rest of us, or the rest of you, that we knew how to make bread from wild yeast.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the secret that was passed down through, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years, thousands of years. And that's why in the old days, a baker was, you know, kind of a big deal, you know, not so much now, but used to be like the mayor, or, you know, you were like a big deal in a town, because you knew the secret.
Well, you held the magic.
We held the magic, the alchemy. And the alchemy is that essentially there's wild yeast floating around in the air.
Right, okay? Everywhere.
Everywhere around the world, all around the planet.
It's on you, it's on fruit, it's on
everything.
Doesn't
matter where you are. Right. I was in the merchant navy on ships. We did the same thing. Doesn't matter. What happens is if you mix flour and water together, okay, a yeast spore will land on that flour and water and will start to multiply.
Right.
Whilst it multiplies, it produces gas.
Yep, carbon dioxide.
CO2.
Yep.
And this rises the bread. If you've kneaded your bread properly and given it a lot of gluten, this gives you a sort of a balloon. If you can imagine a balloon trapping the gas, that's what makes your bread come up in the air. At the same time as we sort of grow this yeast, we introduce some grapes, onion, potato, whatever makes alcohol, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this also causes a ferment. So now you've got two things going on. You have the yeast rising the bread, then you also have a ferment, like when you make beer and wine, and this improves the flavor.
Right. Well, a byproduct of the yeast is alcohol too, right? When
exactly.
The yeast die, they create.
Yeah. All right, so now what happens now is that that's basically, you don't need a little packet of yeast, and you don't need a lump of, in the old days as well, another trick was to use the leftover sort of mulch from making beer. And this is, you know, how you mixed in with your flour and water, and this would also rise your bread. But if you didn't have access to this, you could just simply, you know, mix flour and water together, wait for a while. It's kind of I don't want to get too into the, you know, complicated. Everyone makes it out to be very, very complicated. Like, oh, you've got to feed it this, that, do all these little things to it. You just got to mix flour and water together, equal parts. The yeast will come. You tip half away. You feed it with the same amount, flour and water, every day, once a day. And after about 5 days, it will be bubbling and boiling, kind of like you're a witch. You did it.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the secret.
That's it.
Okay, so the trick,
itself.
Yeah, exactly. It does its own thing. Now, obviously, if you do it somewhere close to another bakery, it'll come really quickly. If you do it in the middle of Nebraska, I don't know if it would do it in Nebraska slower, but, you know, if you can imagine, you need to get one or two of these yeast spores into it. Now, it works everywhere. So this went on for ages and ages and ages. Everyone made bread like this, and you had these lovely breads that tasted sour and delicious and crunchy, you know, crusts and all that business, cooked in a fire, lovely dark bread, everything great. And then at some point, essentially it was the early in the 1900s when early wars were raging, and America decided to unleash its secret weapon on the world, which was dried yeast. And they had like a team of scientists on the job, sort of like the Manhattan Project, but only yeast, all right?
All our worst food technology comes out of the war effort.
Well, there you go. So what happens is that now suddenly you could take this powdered yeast. Nobody else had it, only the Americans. And so what they could do is they could move large amounts of troops around. All they had to have was flour. They could get water out of a river, and they had to have some of this dried yeast and some salt. You mix these things together within 3 or 4 hours. If you get an oven going, you're making bread. You can feed all your guys. You can rule the world. Basically, that's what happened. Mm. Then what happened is, after this all settled down, the guys that invented or had the industrial yeast, the powdered yeast, they said, oh, well, this is a great thing. We'll sell it to everyone at home and all the regular bakeries, and then we can all have Wonder Bread. So that's what happened.
Yeah.
In America, you got Wonder Bread for your troubles, sort of penance, really. Oh, no, I'm not allowed to say that.
Punishment.
Well, whatever. Anyway, so now you have Wonder Bread for the 50s. 50s, it really started kicking in. 60s, it was all about white and all that business. Kind of we went back to hundreds of years. At that point, we actually went reverse hundreds of years back because, you know, hundreds of years ago, the peasants ate rye bread with all the good stuff in it. That's why they were all hearty and hale. And the rich kings and queens ate only the white, the inside of the wheat and kernel, and subsequently they all got gout and had terrible diets, and then everyone else was eating rye bread. So, but now it's sort of reversed, you see, because now it's started again, isn't it?
Right.
And now it's I don't want to say this, but it seems like a lot of affluent people eat rye bread and all the whole wheat breads and all the fabulous, right?
Of course.
And then the poorer people or the people that don't have the money to buy this stuff all end up eating Wonder Bread again.
Yep.
But basically, it has changed 20, 30 years now. America is now probably has the best bread in the world, actually, because there's so many bakeries, small bakeries, making fabulous bread using these old techniques, the old baker's secret. And the one thing about America is, which is beautiful, is that everyone shared the information. So once it started, many, many bakeries started doing it. And that was the one, which is a great thing. And now, American teams, bread teams are doing very, very well in all these competitions, which I personally hate. But nevertheless, the fact that they're doing very, very well is great. It's not the fact that they're doing well I hate. The fact the competitions I don't like. But anyway, the fact that the American breads are doing so well up against everyone, all the best bakers in the world.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to say it, but yeah. Okay. So... it's amazing, really.
Yeah.
Right?
It's amazing.
It is amazing.
Well, it's amazing that the American team won the Coupe du Monde a few years ago in pastry.
Well, it's a in terms of bread, it's sort of revolutionary. And now I think that they're, everyone else is sort of really rushing to catch up.
Right, to catch up with us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the joke being that we were all doing this, 150 years ago. Even back before in the 1800s, everyone was still doing it then, and we had great bread, and now suddenly we're all in a panic to get back to what we call artisan bread. Also a word I dislike. It's just bread cooked how it's supposed to be cooked, or baked how it's supposed to be baked. And then you've got the whole wood oven thing. Of course, a lot of people cooking in wood ovens and burning their bread, which anyone who's out there, I must tell you, must cook your bread very, very dark, because the flavour of the bread inside comes from the crust on the outside, and as the bread cools, the darkness of the crust sucks into your internal crumb and gives you this lovely rich flavor on top of the flavor that you already got by making a ferment, and also by making your starter or sourdough, whatever form you're using.
Wow, that was like a manifesto.
Sort of, yeah. The dark bread thing's really important.
It is. Well, and not only flavor-wise, but also as far as antioxidants. The darker you roast that wheat on the surface, the more antioxidants it has, apparently.
There's something about, you've got to be careful with charcoal, haven't you? You guys, when you do the meat.
You shouldn't eat burnt
too
things.
Much burnt stuff.
Right, it develops carcinogens.
Right, so you better scrape your toast off
you're damned
it.
If you do.
Yeah, or you don't.
Either way. Yeah.
Take it from me.
Okay, we're going to take another very short break, and we'll come back and talk some more about bread.
Good.
You know, when the weather gets warm, same things on our minds as you boys do.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Hearst Ranch. Woo! Welcome back to Why We Cook, the Chef Smarty Pants radio show. I'm Erica Wide, Chef Smarty Pants, your host. This is episode 76 of Why We Cook. Last week was my 75th anniversary. And if you are a fan of the show, I would love to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook. Just search for Why We Cook on Heritage Radio. I got a couple of great comments from people this week. Thank you. And also, I just came back from Ohio where I did an Earth to Table dinner, a fundraiser dinner at the Culinary Vegetable Institute. It was a fundraiser for their program called Veggie U at the Chef's Garden. And I had a fan at the dinner. It was great. She came up to me, said she was a fan. It was really nice. And I think you're the same person who posted on Facebook. So thank you for that also. But that was really great. It was a great dinner. We had a really good time, Beej and I. I've talked about Beej here before. And we will also be back out there in July for their Food and Wine Festival. July, I think, 18th, whatever that Saturday is. So if you're in the Midwest and you want a really fun weekend, you can come out there. It's in Milan, Ohio. Milan, Ohio. Not Milan, Milan. Anyway, so we're in the studio tonight with Sim Cass, my colleague and pal, who is a extraordinary bread baker. And so we teach together at ICE, but you also do all the bread for Balthazar.
Well, now these days I'm sort of just the
you're sort of the director,
bit of a
of
princess
it.
Now. Mm. I just roll in on
oversee.
Occasions. I'm like, yeah, spoilt, completely spoilt.
You never really get your hands in the
dough
anymore.
No, they're completely on their own trip and doing really, really well.
But you've designed the bread program for them.
Oh, at the college?
No, at Balthazar.
Balthazar, I was a founding baker with Paula Olin back in the first days of Balthazar, the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's done very well. And now over there in Jersey, which is like the second bakery, which is a very, very large bakery, they make, basically natural ferment up to about 10 tons a day.
Wow.
So this is sort of a...
Wow.
Proves a point that, you know, even when you're working with natural ferment and making, using large amounts of starter that's being fed four times a day and, you know, bread being produced 24 hours a day, it can be done.
It can be done.
Yeah. And most bakeries that are worth their salt are realizing and I've already realized basically, but more and more bakers are just like, oh, yeah, well, we have to have natural ferment going on.
Yeah, it's what people are expecting now. I mean, people, you sort of get a taste for it, and that's what you want. You want the real bread.
Yeah,
and it's interesting because, you know, in 50, 70 years ago, in this sort of rush toward industrialization, with the invention of instant yeast and, you know, mechanization of bakeries and all that, you could make massive quantities of bread within a couple of hours, but it had no flavor. It was white. It was cottony. It had no flavor at all. And people really lost the taste for that. I think what people, if they're not familiar with bread baking, don't realize is it's a very long, slow process. And the longer and slower you do it, the better it tastes. And that's what I try to explain also when I'm teaching, because even in our culinary program, we have some situations where we have to make dough and let it rise. And the recipe will always say, put it in a warm place and give it an hour, you know. And I say to my students, well, yeah, it'll rise in an hour in a warm place, but it won't have any flavor, you know. So when you do, you know, your sort of classic sourdough boule at Balthazar when you're teaching, I mean, what's the fermentation time involved?
Right. Well, quickly we have, ideally, everything should take as long as possible.
Right. And as cool as possible temperature.
And the ideal temperature. Ideal for a mixed dough. That means after you've had it in the machine and mixed it for a while on, say, 3 minutes slow and maybe 4 minutes fast, just as a rough idea, and you have this nice developed gluten, nice smooth dough, it's for an average, and good average is about 75 degrees. All right, now if you think that you're 98.7, that's a good 20 degrees cooler than you. Mm-hmm. So if you're at home and you're making bread and you're like, oh my God, it's too cold. No, that's correct. As long as you can make it, if it takes 5 hours to come up, it's okay. It's just going to give you more flavor. And the biggest trick of all is that when you're proving your dough, you turn it in the bins. That means 1, 2, 3, 4 into itself, and then turn it upside down and cover it again. If you do that every hour, you will open up more planes for the yeast mm-hmm. to eat,
right.
kind of like the universe folding into itself and expanding.
Right, you have to give them a new food source.
Exactly,
they can't move on their own. Yeah,
that's gonna. Even though the dough's gonna be really, really cold, you're gonna get more and more, you know, CO2 developed from the yeast that's feeding on these new planes. And mm-hmm. I would say that was the number one trick or two tricks: cool doughs, folding. Don't be scared to fold that dough 3 or 4 times, like 3 or 4 hours. Mm-hmm. Fold. Mm-hmm. It will rise.
Mm. There you go. Yeah, I actually learned how to bake bread up at the CIA from a guy named Rich Coppedge. Do you know him? Are you familiar with him?
Familiar with his name, yeah.
He was incredible. He was an amazing bread instructor and taught me a lot. And we did breads in his class where we refrigerated the dough overnight, you know, 12, 15 hours. So it was really low and slow.
Right.
And it was great. I mean, the flavor was incredible. It's, you know, it's not something you can say in an afternoon like, oh, let's make some bread. You have to really plan it out.
Right.
It's a long-term project. It's like making beer or anything else that involves fermentation, which I have talked about on the show a lot. I've done shows on kimchi and sauerkraut and, you know, all kinds of fermented products where it's a long, slow process. You really have to let nature do its job and not rush it.
Exactly. I mean, just quickly, I like to work in ascent at all times and not retard. That's just me. So that means you keep the dough really cold and you work it for a lot. You let it rise over this series of times all the way to the oven. Long ferment without retarding. Retarding is really great, but it doesn't give you oven spring.
So retarding is putting it in the fridge.
Yeah.
You mean taking it too cold,
yeah.
really.
Well, that's when you hold it in bread shape.
Uh-huh.
Molded shape and then retard.
Okay,
and then you bring it out, let it come up again, and put it in the oven.
But I
personally believe it should just be a long, slow ascent.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, I had to get that in.
Okay,
you know, I was getting a bit obsessive there.
It's okay. You're entitled to your opinion. I actually can't remember if we retarded once it was shaped or not.
Well, you held cold. That's another conversation. Anyway, I've really enjoyed this.
Me too.
You've got me started now.
I can really
get going here now. We're running out of time.
Yeah, we need to give you 12, 15 hours of a long, slow rise to really get going. Yeah.
I am 54 now.
Well,
you
don't look a day over 50. Well, yeah, we are just about out of time, but thank you so much for coming all the way out here and experiencing the Heritage Radio Network world. And I'd love to have you back on anytime you want to come on and talk about bread some more. You are surely welcome to come.
Okay. It was very nice to be here.
Thank you.
And my only advice, or more advice, is with bread, just do it every day. It's just sort of like religion, really. It grows on you, you know. Anyway, good night to you all. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, Sim. So we're out of time. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.